Well, thank you. Imagine yourselves standing next to the photographer here and facing this massive wall of dust. Now, that would be anticipating the health risks of dust, I think. And then be glad that you weren't. So the premise behind this talk is straightforward, and that is we can anticipate the health effects of dust when we know several factors. When we know where the dust sources are and the conditions responsible for dust emission from them. When we understand the properties of dust, the sizes of the particles, the chemistry, and the mineralogy. When we can track the dust from sources into populated areas using satellite images and wind models. And when we can forecast dust emission from predicted areas of drought. So we would like eventually to forecast where the dust is coming from under drought, future drought conditions, and also areas where we expect human activities to disturb landscapes. Well, I'm first going to talk in general about dust sources and some of the health risks associated with dust from certain kinds of dust sources. And this will take us to what we might call a tale of two cities. One city is Las Vegas, and the other city is Salt Lake City. And you might be surprised to learn which one is now suffering from foolishness, at least with respect to dust. Wisdom is nowhere to be found, certainly not in this talk, but one of our goals is to improve land management practices so we can avoid some of the practices of past few years that are actually causing huge dust problems in Western North America. So we've seen maps similar to this showing the largest areas of dust emission around the world, and I'm going to talk about these relatively small pink arrows in Western North America. So I'm going to limit my comments to dust in Western North America. Now these are minor on a global scale, but they affect a lot of people and all of our Western ecosystems. And even so, we see very large dust storms recurring year after year in the American West. Here is a geostationary satellite image of a large dust front moving across most of the state of Kansas and eastern Colorado in 1999. Excuse me. Here's a dust cloud coming in over Phoenix in front of a convective storm in the summer of 2006. So dust in Western North America, for us, is not insignificant. Well, we can make a list, then, a very simple list of the properties and components in dust that can affect human health. And Suzette and others have already talked about the issues of particulate matter, PM10, particulate matter less than 10 micrometers in aerodynamic diameter, PM2.5. We know that these can go far into the lungs. They exacerbate cardiovascular disease, and they kill. The asbestiform minerals, these are rather well known for causing pulmonary disease, including mesothelioma. The potentially toxic metals and metalloids, herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers from agricultural lands, and finally, pathogens of all kinds from many sources. And I'll limit my talk today to the issues of particulate matter and metals. We can also make a long list of dust sources, and we can associate these different potential health risks with the different dust sources. And these include both natural dust sources and dust sources caused by human activity. And we see here a much longer list of dust sources caused by human activity. And all natural dust sources can be further disturbed by what we do on the landscape, again, exacerbating dust emission. I'm going to have to limit my comments today to two settings. These are the dry lakes or playa settings in the American West. And then an example of a burned area that was then, was a natural burned area, but it was later disturbed by human activity in an attempt to rehabilitate that area. And I guess I do have a disclosure to make, and that's not our field vehicle. So I'll start off with dry lakes, and this is a photograph of dust emission from Owens Dry Lake in Southern California. This was the biggest emitter of PM10 in North America until a few years ago, where mitigation, very expensive mitigation efforts were put into place, but it still emits dust. And these dusts, as you can see here, are made up of of what we call evaporite minerals. These are salt mineral dust coming from a salty surface of this lake. And these salts have been known by, because of the work by Marith Rieheis and Jeff Plumley in the audience, to be enriched in many potentially toxic metals. Well, we recognize different kinds of dry lakes. They're not all the same, and this is an important distinction. We recognize the wet playa. These are fascinating things. These are extraordinary features on the Earth's surface. These are the cases where the groundwater table is very close to the surface, and this water can evaporate through the thin zone of sediment, leaving behind the salt minerals and in the sediment and also as white crusts on the surface. And sometimes these salt crusts can be very thick and they resist wind erosion, but they can also, at the other end of the spectrum, be very, very thin and fluffy and can be entrained into the atmosphere even under rather gentle winds. And these crusts, these salt mineral crusts, can lie somewhere in between, being a few millimeters thick, and these can be shredded by strong winds, winds in excess of 20, 25 meters per second to produce dust. Dry playas are extremely boring, and we shouldn't even talk about them. Groundwater table does not communicate with the surface. They're covered with a hard mud crust, and they do not generate dust unless they're driven over by recreational vehicles or tanks, and that happens often enough. Well, we're studying a number of different playas in the Mojave Desert of Southern California, Southern Nevada. I'm going to talk about two of them, Franklin Lake Playa, 100 kilometers west of Las Vegas, and Mesquite Lake Playa, 60 kilometers to the southwest of Las Vegas. So here's Franklin Lake Playa, and here and in other places, we study the groundwater chemistry and the sources of the groundwater, how the water evaporates, leaving behind at the surface these salt mineral crusts, how over periods of years, these crusts then turn into dust. We collect dust in a number of different ways, in part by using these portable wind tunnels produced by Desert Research Institute. We collect dust here, and we subject the dust to a lot of different kinds of analyses, particle sizes, chemistry of all kinds, and including subjecting them to leaching in the simulated biofluids that Suzette just talked about. So this is to assess the bioaccessibility of potentially toxic metals such as arsenic, cadmium, uranium, and so on. And this slide summarizes some of Suzette's work on Franklin Lake Playa. Here's a picture of the playa. And these are arsenic extractions from dust in these simulated biofluids, with black for intestinal, red for gastric, and green for the lung simulated fluids. And we see here relatively low amounts of arsenic, and this is true not just in the bioaccessible arsenic, it's true in the bulk dust samples and also the crust samples. The lowest amounts of these of the extracted arsenic coming from the parts of the playa beneath which the groundwater is the most saline and the most enriched in arsenic. The highest amounts of arsenic in groundwater are right in this area here, yielding the lowest amounts of arsenic in the crust, the dust, and the bioaccessible arsenics. The highest amount of arsenic in this system is coming from a part of the playa beneath which the groundwater is relatively dilute and relatively low in arsenic. Now, this is a real conundrum. And after many years of work and digging lots of holes and doing lots of chemical analyses of these sediments, we have come up with this explanation. In thick evaporation zones, when the groundwater table is on the order of several meters below the surface, water still evaporates through the top. The metals move with the water up here, but the metals accumulate in salt minerals beneath the evaporation front. This is the horizon above which ascending evaporating water then turns into water vapor. The water vapor rises. It doesn't carry the metals with it, and few metals are accumulated at the surface. In thin evaporation zones, though, with a groundwater table just a few centimeters, a few tens of centimeters below the surface, metals can move upward with the ascending evaporating waters, and they accumulate in the salt minerals at the surface. And so based on this kind of work, if we understand groundwater chemistry and the depth to the groundwater table, we should be able to predict then the metal loadings in the salt crust and the dust coming from them. And now we turn to our first city, Las Vegas. So here's a geostationary satellite image. The satellite is parked over the eastern Pacific here, and it's looking northeastward across Southern California, across Southern Nevada. Here's Las Vegas. And this photograph was taken early afternoon on April 15th, 2002. There's lots of dust in the air this day. It was a huge windstorm. But I draw your attention to this streak going from here directly into Las Vegas. And that streak of dust, that's a thick plume of dust coming from Mesquite Lake Playa, and it's going directly into Salt Lake City. I have a lot of interesting work on the deflation and the dust emission from this playa, but it's an extremely active playa, and we see this kind of pattern recurring time and time again. Why does the dust from Mesquite Lake Playa go directly into Las Vegas time and time again? And that's because of wind focusing by topography in Southern California. So in wind models that have been developed and run by Gary Clough and our group, we find that when strong winds come onshore in these low-pressure troughs that are typical of the windy season in spring, that wind gets funneled through a wind gap south of the Sierra Nevada, and that wind explodes through the Mojave Desert. Here, the highest winds are shown in these white colors, encompassed by the red winds greater than 20 meters per second. And it turns out when these strong winds hit the bottom of Mesquite Lake Playa, they're directed through a saddle in a mountain range to the northeast of Mesquite Lake Playa up through here. And that directs these dust plumes directly into the city of Las Vegas. And so what do we know about some of this dust coming from Mesquite Lake Playa into Las Vegas? Well, it's got, on average, the dust has, on average, approximately 80 parts per million uranium, 80 parts per million uranium. It's approaching 10 parts per million, I'm sorry, arsenic, 80 parts per million arsenic, approaching 10 parts per million uranium here, and it's very fine grained. We see that of the silt size fraction, more than 40% is PM10, and about 10% is PM2.5, and that's just at the starting gate. That's just beginning. That's just the dust from Mesquite Lake Playa. It gets much finer by the time it gets into Las Vegas. And we can attribute air quality and deterioration of air quality in Las Vegas to the arrival of far-traveled dust from the Mojave Desert. And we can do that using these geostationary satellite images that are acquired every 15 minutes. We actually make movies of these dust storms with 15-minute intervals. So here's the dust from Mesquite Lake Playa in Las Vegas. We actually tracked this day that the arrival of that dust plume. We see PM10 levels in Las Vegas below the 150 micrograms per cubic meter EPA 24-hour standard. And bam, that dust from Mesquite Lake Playa and other places in the Mojave Desert arrive in Las Vegas, and PM10 levels rise to nearly 1,500. Now, the other city is Salt Lake City. And here, there was an interesting observation made in the spring of 2008, and that was that all of a sudden, there was a new dust source appearing in Utah. It had never been seen before. It didn't exist before. And all of a sudden, it was the biggest source sending dust into Salt Lake City and other urban areas along the Wasatch Front. And we can see, again, in these geostationary satellite images, this area we now call the Milford Fire Dust Source. And it's sending dust directly up into Salt Lake City in April 19, 2008. Sevier Lake is a wet playa of the kind I've talked about before. It's always been active as far as we know, or since it's been in this particular state. It's sending dust up in this area too, but the Milford fire area dust is much more dense on these kinds of images. There are other dust sources active too, but this is now the biggest one, and it was just found in 2008. Mark Miller in our group jumped on this right away, and he found that the dust was coming from the Milford flat fire area. It was a natural lightning strike fire that burned in July of 2007. It was a huge fire, over 1,500 kilometers burned. And it burned shrubland on a very flat landscape that was underlain by old lake sediments on the order of 20,000 years old. So they're very, very fine-grained to begin with, but it was a shrubland, and so it didn't emit any dust. There was a strong wind effect here. The wind is focused through this area. and there's a large wind fetch. And so it had all the characteristics for dust because, and only because, the Bureau of Land Management decided to actually make the landscape better, to improve the landscape after the fire, and so they got a lot of money, and this is what they did. They tore out all the roots of the dead and living plants. They completely crunched the biologic soil crust, all those elements in the landscape that would otherwise stabilize the soil and suppress dust emission and wind erosion were removed from the landscape. It was absolutely obliterated. Oh, and they applied herbicide also before they did this, so then nothing could grow, not even the invasive annual plants that otherwise would have suppressed dust emission. This is what they did. And so this is one of the take-home slides from Mark Miller. We were collecting dust in these kinds of dust collectors that actually measured horizontal dust flux. And Mark found that the land that was burned but untreated did not emit any more dust than the land equivalent landscapes that were unburned. But where the land was treated to improve the rangeland, here and here, and the rain did not follow, they planted grass seed, but rain did not follow the plow in this particular case. So in these kinds of treated areas, this was the picture of dust emission, highly variable based on lots of different factors that Mark identified. But more than 20,000 grams per meter squared per day of dust, and that dust is going into Salt Lake City. And we can actually now follow the arrival of that dust from Milford Flat and a few other sources in the area that were active during these windstorms. We can now attribute deterioration of air quality in Salt Lake City and other urban areas along the Wasatch Front to the arrival of this far-traveled dust. So on April 19th, 2008, the arrival of far-traveled dust leads to PM10 levels exceeding 700 micrograms per cubic meter. And similarly, over here in March 2009, these vertical green arrows correspond to the times during which these images were acquired. We see here, with the arrival of the dust from Milford Flats and Sevier Lake, PM10 levels now getting up to 400 micrograms per cubic meter, and going on later that day to exceed about 800. So what can we expect in the future? As Nick so well pointed out, we can expect drying and warming in the Southwest. We are already on that trajectory. So we can expect more dust in the future just on the basis of this multi-decadal expectation. It also turns out that many of the native plant species that stabilize Southwestern landscapes, such as native bunch grasses and even a lichen that's a very important part of our biologic soil crust that stabilizes soils, are not faring well under already observed increasing temperatures. They are in demise. These are important soil stabilizers. They will no longer be able to keep the dust down as they have in the past. If we look out just a few decades, this condition of drying will be exacerbated if we enter what's called the negative state Pacific decadal oscillation, representing cooling of sea temperatures in the North Pacific. We'll see more La Nina-type conditions, more drying of the Southwest if we enter that phase. But we're most interested in looking down the road just a few months. And here we're going to consult forecasts of soil moisture and precipitation. So we want to know now, today, what the dust situation is, or what the drought situation is going to be like in April, in March, April, and May, when we get most of the wind in the Southwest. Here's an example of how this might work. This is a map of drought conditions produced by Lifeng Luo. He's now at Michigan State. He made this map in November 2008 for April 2009. We today can go and get this map for April 2011. And our interest is in finding out the areas of predicted drought and where these intersect with areas of known dust sources. We can pay particular attention to these, and downwind populations then might be interested in knowing what to expect. There's a lot of work to be done. One piece of work I'd like to point out is that we'd like to work with this community to study exposed populations to provide perhaps more direct analysis of the effects of dust on populations. And again, finally, we'd like to be able to forecast dust emission from drought prediction and expected human disturbances. And that brings me to the last slide, again, one that Nick nicely helped introduce. And that last slide over here on the left is a Landsat image, a satellite image of Salton Sea in Southern California. It's about 55 kilometers long. Policies are now in place to divert water now used for agriculture, or until recently used for agriculture, for this region down here, and divert that water to urban uses in Southern California. This will cause inevitably a drying out of this lake. There won't be as much water to maintain this sea level on this inland sea, so that by the year 2036, about 40% of the current sea area here will be exposed as a playa to the wind. That's about 400 square kilometers. So we have to ask the question, will we see in the future, over the next several decades, a small example of what we see today in the Aral Sea? Thank you. Right. This was information from EPA in the second example. Salt Lake City was from the Utah Division of Air Quality. They are short term. We rarely see these kinds of massive emissions for more than really a few hours, 12 hours, maybe 20. Sometimes we get winds now coming in that might last 3 or 4 days. So we'll get 3 or 4 continuous days of dust emission. So that seems to be getting fairly significant, typically less than 20, right?
And then I wonder about the relevance, actually, of the concentration measurement, because the samplers weren't designed to operate under those conditions.
Okay, well, that's a good point, and one I'll have to ask these people. So if you're saying that they actually get overloaded, and so they're underestimating the amounts?
And they don't work well under high heat speeds either.
The samplers are in the areas of deposition, not in the areas of emission. So, it's mostly vertical deposition at that point. Yeah, point was that if there is dust coming out of the Salton Sea, and we would expect this to be the case, it's going to be a pretty messy bit of dust with the runoff from agricultural areas, the herbicides, pesticides, fertilizers, and so on and so forth, as well as metals. And it's actually, there's a hydrothermal system beneath here, too, that's bringing up metals from hot water beneath the surface as well. From depth, so this will be interesting.
Any other questions?
Is the use of taking the water from the Salton Sea, has this been decided? Is this being implemented now?
As much as politics can decide anything permanently, but yes, within the last couple of years or so, Department of Interior has, or even back in 2000, before 2008, it was decided by the previous administration to do this.
So it's, from my perspective, I'm sure it's shared that typically, again, the focus is on the short term, solving a short term problem and not really looking ahead as to what other issues are going to arise.
There is concern and awareness by California Air Quality Department and so on, that this and the county, it's already the dustiest county in California, I believe, already. And so they're aware of this, but it's hard for them to it's been difficult for them to raise this awareness and get this to the top of the list, yeah, because the problem is a few years down the road, and water needs are immediate.
Yeah.